if anyone went to confession, they went to Bishop Francis Shepard. And even after Father Clement came to the community, Bishop Shepard heard a great number of confessions during his early years after being consecrated a bishop. And certainly I would believe he heard most of the confessions of those in the committed the sin of impurity with him and wanted to absolve them. In the spring of 1984, there is on public television in Spokane a series which the person interviewed four former brothers who had been with Shepard and been involved in this sin of impurity. And on this TV program, the television commentator makes mention that these people separated from Shepard between the years 1970 and 1980. And I know personally some of those who were involved in the television program, and they left Shepard in the years 1971 and maybe 1972, not long after he was consecrated a bishop, and some of them in later years. But I think I have somewhere audio of that television program, but rather than dig it all out and find the right spot, I'm going simply now to dub into here part of the tape from the talk that Father Dennis Philemon and me gave to the adult members of the community on Monday, June 4th, 1984, where he speaks about this television program.
Of you watched the TV program on Channel 4 when there was a series of presentations that had to do with various aspects of the community. One of them had to do with the school, and another one had to do with brainwashing and cult, etc., etc. And the other one had to do, one of them had to do with His Excellency, when four former brothers who had their faces, I didn't see it, I heard it, four former brothers were being questioned by the reporter insofar as being molested sexually, and they said they were. And then when they asked the bishop if this were true, he made statements to the effect that I can't respond to that because it's confessional matter and they have a problem anyway. In other words, saying it's not true. Well, I'm telling you that it is true, and that's the problem.
And so I want you to note that Bishop Shepard would not talk about it because it was confessional matter. In other words, he heard the confession and therefore attempted this absolution of the compass and sin and was excommunicated in a most special manner reserved to the Holy See automatically. And if you will listen to the tape of the sermon Father Dennis Philomenime gave on June 17th, 1984, toward the end, he speaks again and about this matter, and he makes mention that Bishop Shepard totally denied the moral issue, flatly and totally denied the moral issue, which is an outright lie. He goes on to say, I counted the other day 17 individuals I know, and I know there are a lot more indirectly, 17 individuals who left the community because they were directly involved with this particular problem. And if he knew 17 who were directly involved, I know myself a number of those who left at different times, and I'm not sure who all was involved with the bishop's problem here, but I know that they did not all leave in 1984 or 1983 or even from 1982. No, they've been leaving all through the years from 1970 on, directly involved with this problem. And from these, then, I conclude, although I have not spoken or tracked down the evidence because I didn't think from my personal convictions I needed to go and talk to each individual left and see who was the first one who Shepard absolved, but I have come to the conclusion from this evidence that Bishop Francis Shepard absolved, or at least attempted to absolve, an accomplice in sin, sometime between 1971 on November 1st, when he was consecrated a bishop, between that date and August 22nd, 1975, when the first religious sisters made their supposedly religious profession. And because Bishop Murphy, you indicated over the telephone conversation this morning that you thought Bishop Shuckard's immoral problem being a homosexual only began just a few years ago, I guess. Let me now delve into what Father Dennis Philominery went on to say right after he told us about these 17 individuals who he knew personally and left the community on this same talk in of June 4th, 1984.
When I met His Excellency 20 years ago and heard one of his lectures, I told you yesterday that we gave up everything and changed our whole life in order to work and spread the message of Fatima and work for Our Lady. And I personally came into contact with this problem, and it shocked me, and I had no idea what to do or what to say. And it was presented to me in a way that it had to do with, it was something due to an illness, and like he almost didn't know what he was doing, et cetera, et cetera. And it just drove me into a state, and finally I left the community when it just first started. And when I left, I took one of the vehicles and raced about 90 miles an hour out of here with the intention of never coming back. This was in the, this was 1966, 1967 when the community first started.
So there you have the words of Father Dennis Philominery that since 1966 or 67, and this is 86, it's 20 years ago, that he's known the bishop to have this problem. And if you listen to all the tapes and talks and hear the letters exchanged during that month of June, July, and August 1984, you'll certainly find that the problem did not start just in 1983 or 1984. What Father Dennis Philominery tells us is that the problems got worse after the bishop started on more drugs in 1978, but it does not in any way imply that Shuckard did not attempt to absolve and encompass in sin between 1971 and 1975. And I would certainly need a complete thorough check out of everyone who left to know that Shuckard did not absolve someone between 1975 and, say, 1980. So what religious have taken religious profession? Again, as far as I'm concerned, from what we still hope to explain to you, nobody. And certainly not those who paid their profession to an excommunicated and suspended superior after 1980. I would ask you again at this time to read over once more this letter that Father Dennis Philominery wrote on June 21st, 1984. And if you have not read it, then read it for the first time. But with this letter he sent out to so many crusaders, he also included a list of applicable canons that pertain to what he wrote in the six-page letter. And on the back side of this sheet, then, he quotes Canon 2394, which says, quote, if a person by his own authority takes possession of an ecclesiastical benefice, office, or dignity, incurs the following penalties. Suspension from or deprivation of any benefice, office, or dignity which he had previously obtained, and even by disposition if the gravity of the offense calls for it, unquote. And so from this canon 2394 we see that Francis Shuckard, as a lay person, was already suspended for taking over the office of being the superior general of this new congregation he founded. For he certainly took it only by his own authority. No ecclesiastical authority appointed him to be the superior general of this new congregation in Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe. And right under that, Father Chicoine writes in this letter, quote, those without canonical privation, certified canons 147 and 332, seize or allow themselves to be illegitimately thrust into or to retain an ecclesiastical office, benefice, or dignity, and all who take part in this incur ipso facto excommunication reserved in the special manager of the apostolic see, unquote. from the commentary on canon law by Will Ward and Smith. So from this, which Father Dennis Filamentary quotes, we find that Francis Shuckart and Father Dennis Filamentary, who was appointed and thrust to illegitimately into the office of being a superior in this new congregation and retaining then this ecclesiastical office of being a vicar general, supposedly of course Shuckart did not have any jurisdiction to make him the vicar general, but he signs this letter using that title. And I will take part in this and cure ipso facto excommunication reserved in a special manner of the apostolic see. Therefore, it obviously follows that neither Bishop Francis Shuckart nor Father Dennis Filamentary, or those superiors of this new congregation, had any lawful office to receive anyone's vows. But now let me return to this book titled Elements of the Religious Life by Reverend William Humphrey, S.J. We're on page 91 now. On the part of the religious, also there are several necessary conditions in order to the validity of his profession. He must have obtained the age which is required by law, had a full year of probation. It goes on, but as we discussed in the phone call this morning, the great majority have never made that year of novitiate. And if you want to look at things lawfully, implicitly, and as they would say, down to the bottom line, no one has made a full year of probation because, in the first place, the congregation was never approved by any lawful ecclesiastical authority. And this is why I said to take note of those dates we read from the conference bulletin showing the bishop's coat of arms. The sister's novitiate was only begun by Francis Shuckart in 1974, and then we read that they supposedly made their final profession in 1975. And with regard to the brothers, the novitiate began in 1975, and those three already made their final profession in 1976, which shows they did not have this full year of probation, followed by the temporary three-year vows, which also now happen to be necessary according to the church laws. Reading on here in the next paragraph from Father Humphrey's works, sometimes religious profession is null and void in such a way that it can never be rectified or made valid. This will be the case if it has been made in accordance with a rule and in a community which has not been approved by the Apostolic See as constituting a religious state. Even if such a body should subsequently be approved, this will not be a ratification of previous profession. Subsequent profession will be religious profession which is made for the first time. So I comment on this that by now I hope it's clear that that is the case with Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. It has never been approved by the Apostolic See as constituting a religious state. Therefore, the vows can never be rectified and made valid. Continuing on with Father Humphrey's work, profession which was invalid is never confirmed simply by lapse of time, even if the defect by reason of which it was invalid should be removed, as, for instance, want of lawful age. There must, as in the case of invalid marriage, which can never begin to be valid solely by lapse of time, be reiteration of consent after removal of the defect. This must be done in such a way as will be efficacious in the present to induce a bond of obligation. Profession which was null and void is, therefore, said to be ratified, not in the sense that the first profession now begins to be valid, but because in place of the first invalid profession, there is now effected a new invalid profession. He who is thus to ratify invalid profession must have knowledge of the previous defect and nullity of it. Without this knowledge, there cannot exist a new consent and sufficient intention to ratify the profession. It is not sufficient that during the time of ignorance of the nullity, the person was in the disposition to have the will to remain in religion. This is not a will to vow or to make profession. It is only a disposition or will to fulfill an obligation which is supposed already to exist. Such a will is not sufficient to ratify a vow. And now I'm commenting on what Father Humphrey wrote here to say that if some way it's going to try and be rectified, and all the people, supposedly congregation Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe, are going to make vows again, they must have this full story of why their previous vows are not real vows, the first time that they thought that they were. And Father Humphrey goes on, if the reception of the religious habit was no part of the term of probation which is founded upon it can be reckoned in order to complete the year of probation which is necessary to validity of profession. There must be a new and valid reception, and therefore an entire year of probation before profession. If the reception to the religious habit was valid and the profession was null, as having been made before the end of the term of probation, the whole time of perseverance in religion under the idea of valid profession will in no way avail towards completing the year of probation. During that time, the person was not on probation. It was not, therefore, a time of noviceship. He who has been invalidly professed can lawfully refuse to ratify his profession. He is free to abandon the habit without in conscience incurring the ecclesiastical penalties of apostasy or excommunication, since his invalid profession did not constitute him a religious, nor did it bind him to perseverance. And now I'm over on page 93, and it reads, it is certain, as the sacred congregation and the council several times declared, that the renovation of vows, which is made annually in some orders, as prescribed by their rules, which have been approved by the Apostolic See, does not render an invalid profession valid. And I'm commenting now to insert that because the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe sometimes has the religious renew their vows in a public way on certain feasts, maybe in the Feast of Her Mother Perpetual Health, that certainly in no way means they're taking their religious vows on that date. And just for information, I'm going to now read from page 188. It does not follow from the institution or approbation of a religious order that it should possess jurisdiction. Religious orders do not possess jurisdiction in virtue of common law. It is conferred on them by way of special concession. To show us that even if the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe was approved, which we've shown it is not, still from that approbation, it did not receive the necessary jurisdiction, and whoever conferred it in a special way on the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe, nobody, because you cannot obtain jurisdiction through Epikaya. And now I'm reading on page 247 and 248, he is not a true apostate, nor does he incur the penalties of apostasy, he is not a true religious. Neither is one an apostate who has made three simple vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience in the world, whether in a private manner of life or in a community, with a rule which has not been approved by the Church as a true religious order. All true religious, even those who have made only simple vows in order approved by the Church as a true religious state, become a criminal departure from the order, truly apostates, and incur the penalties imposed by common law. And I'm commenting now from what Father Humphrey just wrote here to tell us that Noah then is an apostate who left the congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe because they were not true religious, and their private vows in the world, although some thought them to be taking public vows, were not making them truly religious. To give us a better understanding of this last thing I mentioned, let me now turn to a book titled The Spirit of Sacrifice and the Life of Sacrifice in the Religious State from the original Reverend S.M. Gerard, missionary priest of Our Lady of La Salette, revised by the Reverend Herbert Thruston, S.J., 2nd edition, New York, Cincinnati, Chicago, Benzingen Brothers, printers, to the Apostolic See, Nihil Obstate by Remney LaFort, and an imprimatur by John M. Farley, Archbishop of New York, copyright 1905. And I turn now to chapter 2, page 235, on the religious vows. By the religious vow is meant the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience taken in an institute approved by the Holy See. These three vows form the essence of the religious life. The religious life has been defined as, quote, a permanent fixed manner of life approved by the Church, in which the faithful pledge themselves to strive after perfection by means of the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, taken in accordance with the rule of the order, unquote. Paragraph 1. It is said to be a fixed and permanent manner of life approved by the Church. Without the approbation of the highest ecclesiastical authority, what warranty would the faithful possess for the excellence of the most perfect rules of an order to all appearance most fervent? And in trying to explain even more clearly the reason why the Church must approve these religious orders or congregations, let me read from the Catechism on the Religious State in conformity with the Code of Canon Law by Louis Fanfani, O.P., B. Herder Book Company, has it in Premata by Joseph E. Ritter, STD, Archbishop of St. Louis, September 30th, 1955. And I now turn to page 10, the different kinds of religious institutes. Question 22, what is a religious institute? Answer, a religious institute, or more simply, religion, in the sense in which we are presently treating it, is, quote, a society approved by legitimate ecclesiastical authority, whose members strive after evangelical perfection by observing the special laws of that society and by making public vows, either perpetual or temporary, the latter to be renewed when the time expires, unquote. And that's from Canon 488, Section 1. Question 23. Why is the approval of the Church required in order to have a religious institute? Answer. Because it belongs to the Church to judge whether or not a form of religious life is really good and conforms to the spirit of the gospel. Also because the establishing of the various religious associations enters within the dominion of her hierarchical power, whereby she has the right and duty to provide and preserve organizations among the faithful. Finally, because the Church has the obligation to confirm the rights and duties which the faithful, either as individuals or as societies, have as members within the very bosom of herself, the perfect society. And I just read in this question 22, this definition for the religious institute, that it's necessary that one make public vows. So now I turn over to page 56 on the various kinds of vows and read question 124. When are vows said to be public and when are they private? Answer. Vows are said to be public when they're accepted by the lawful superior in the name of the Church. You can see Canon 1308, Section 1. Vows are private or of devotion when they lack this official acceptance on the part of the Church. Each of the faithful, if it so pleases him, can oblige himself before God to do something more in his Christian life than is absolutely required. He can, out of his particular devotion and fervor of spirit, make vows. However, the vows are considered private if the authority of the Church is not called upon to confirm them. In order that vows be considered public, the Church empowers religious superiors to accept them in her name in the form of a quasi-contract. And question 25 asks, are the vows of religion made in a religious institute considered private or public? Answer, religious vows to be truly those of religious must always be public. Indeed, they are religious vows precisely because they are public, that is, accepted by the Church. You can see Canon 488.1. So I'm just commenting again that if there's no lawful authority in the Church, then you simply do not make a religious vow. And now maybe you realize why I asked you to take special note of the dates when I referred to the bulletin showing the Bishop's coat of arms of the 10th year of his anniversary of his consecration and the calendar events. If we return again to 1975 and read Feast of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, First Final Vows, Ceremonies for the Sisters at the City of Mary, August 22nd, we should realize now that all of those sisters who took those vows had only made private vows up till the bishop approved the congregation at the very best, even if he had ecclesiastical jurisdiction and authority, which he did not. And I'm stating this because, remember, I read here on pages 3 and 4 of this bulletin, Murray's little band make their first religious vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience on the Feast of the Most Holy Rosary in 1967. Those were private vows, but not public vows, and therefore they were not religious vows. But the church law now tells us you must make a 3-year novitiate before you can make final profession. And the year I supposedly made religious profession, in 1977, there was also, for example, a brother Mary Joseph who had been in the religious congregation longer than me. He had supposedly finished his 5-year probation that same year I finished my 3-year probation and made vows the same night I did as our supposedly final profession, which he himself admitted, or should admit, that those at best could only have been private vows and therefore no religious profession, obviously. But to make this more clear, hopefully, and maybe bring out how much deceit had taken place, flip over to page 8 of this bulletin, and you will see a picture of the ordination of the consecration ceremonies of Bishop Francis Shuckhart by Bishop Daniel Q. Brown. And in this picture, it shows also 3 other supposedly religious who might believe to be Brother Michael Marie, Father Mary Gagel, and Father Dennis Philomena Marie. And in the picture, it shows them already wearing the religious habit with a brown scapular. And I can't see too clearly because of where he stands, but it seems that Brother Michael Marie is already wearing a cincture, and it's very obvious that Father Dennis Philomena Marie is wearing a cincture, which means that he supposedly made his 3-year profession. And now look at this date. This was November 1st, 1971, and you flip back again to page 6, and it's only 1972 that his excellency gives the Episcopal approbation to the religious congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. And here they already have at least 3-year vows, and the congregation has never been approved. And I've already pointed out that Bishop Tryon certainly did not approve it. I was around the congregation since 1971, and as a religious since August 22nd, 1972, and I know of no time that Father Dennis Philomena Marie made any kind of religious vows until he took his public vows in 1975. And with that being said, let me now turn to the priest's new ritual. We're open to the section that has the reception of converts, and this then contains basically the adjuration of error in the profession of faith that Francis Shuckhart had all the crusaders take when they joined his church. But this is the reception of converts that the Catholic Church has always held out and required when you receive a Protestant into the faith. And the second last paragraph of this profession of faith reads, "And I believe in everything else that has been defined and declared by the sacred canons and by the general councils, and particularly by the Holy Council of Trent, and delivered, defined, and declared by the general council of the Vatican, especially concerning the primacy of the Roman Pontiff and his infallible teaching authority." And so as Catholics, if we believe everything defined and declared by the sacred canons and by the general councils, and particularly by the Holy Council of Trent, let me turn now to the canons and decrees of the Sacred and Ecumenical Council of Trent, celebrated under the Sovereign Pontiffs Paul III, Julius III, and Pius IV, translated by the Reverend J. Waterbury. And I turn now to page 296, under chapter 15. "Profession shall not be made except after a year's probation and at the age of 16 years completed. In no religious order whatever shall the profession, whether of men or women, be made before the age of 16 years is completed, nor shall anyone be admitted to profession who has been less than a year under probation from the time of taking the habit. And any profession made sooner than this shall be null, and shall not superinduce any obligation to the observance of any rule or of any religious body or order, or entail any other effects whatsoever. Next page over in 247, under chapter 16, it reads, when the period of the novitiate is ended, the superiors shall admit those novices whom they have found qualified to profession, or they shall dismiss them from the monastery, to show us once more the great importance of a full year of novitiate before you can make a valid religious profession. So now let me turn back again to this catechism on the religious life and turn to page 43 under question 92. How long must the novitiate last? Answer. In every religious institute, the novitiate must last at least one full and continuous year under penalty of making the profession null and void. Canon 555, 1 and 2. The year is to be computed according to the calendar. Hence, if the novitiate began October 1st and ends on October 1st of the following year, even if there be a question of a leap year. For the year to be integral, it is necessary to compute from the end of the day on which the novitiate was started to the year following, regardless of the hour in which the novitiate started. Thus, if the novitiate began at 8 in the morning of September 30th, the year of novitiate does not end at 8 o'clock of the morning of September 30th of the following year, but at midnight of the 30th, so that the profession cannot be made until October 1st has begun. And that's what it reads, and therefore it shows us once more the great importance of how strict the church is in having this complete year and all the many other things that are entailed. And now I would like to turn to a practical commentary of the Code and Canon Law by Reverend Stanislaus Woolworth, revised by Reverend Calixtus Smith, Volume 1, turning to page 214 under paragraph 436. Persons who have taken the vows, either temporary or perpetual, by a religious organization cannot validly be received into any novitiate. Even if the vows have ceased or been dispensed with, such a person cannot again become a religious without the dispensation of the Holy See. And so I comment on that to state again that a great majority, or at least a good percentage of those in the congregation of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe, by the time that Shekhar put them through their supposedly year of novitiate, already had vows, at least temporary. So it says right here, they did not make a valid novitiate because they could not be validly received into the novitiate. Going to the next page on 215, paragraph 438, it reads, among those who cannot be licitly admitted to the novitiate, the code mentions in the first place clerics and major orders. And I told you over the phone this morning that no priest made a year novitiate, and myself was the only one who supposedly was even put through the year novitiate. But at that time I was already finally professed, a religious priest, and still supposedly the master of novices and the superior and everything of the novice brothers, of which I was supposed to be one of. And I read in the Summa St. Thomas Aquinas on page 2640, the three-volume set, translated by the Dominicans, under the supplement part, question 20, article 3, where he writes, I answer that, for no man can be subject to himself. And not only then was I supposedly subject to myself, which St. Thomas says cannot happen, but my year of novitiate did not begin until about a month or a month and a half after the other supposedly novice brothers begin their year of novitiate that particular year. And I've already read the section where you must have a full 365 days with different exceptions that are brought into that, but certainly I was not including those exceptions. One other matter, at least, I wish to point out now, since it does deal with the religious vows, and that comes under the title of ordination for religious. And I read now again from this practical commentary by Woolworth on page 521 of volume 1, paragraph 923. The canonical title for regulars is the solemn religious profession, which is called the, quote, title of poverty, unquote. For religious, with perpetual simple vows, the title of ordination is the title of Mensa Comita per Congregationis, or a similar one according to their constitutions. And what I am simply pointing out here is that only those religious who make solemn vows are ordained under the title of poverty, and only those can make a solemn vow who belong to religious order, and only a pope can approve a religious order. And yet, when I was still with the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe, during the ordination ceremonies, Bishop Francis Shepcart ordained people to the title of poverty, which means that in the mind of Bishop Shepcart, he had founded a religious order and not simply a religious congregation, which means indeed he assumed the papacy. And this then backs up what Father Dennis Philip Minimi quotes in his letter of June 21st, 1984, under the applicable canons, canon 2394, which I've already read but reread now. If a person by his own authority takes possession of an ecclesiastical benefice, office, or dignity, incurs the following penalties: suspension from or deprivation of any benefice, office, or dignity which he had previously obtained, and even by disposition, if the gravity of the offense calls for it. And going on, those who without canonical provision seize or allow themselves to be illegitimately thrust into or to retain an ecclesiastical office, benefice, or dignity, and all who take part in this incur ipso facto excommunication is urged in the special manner to the Apostolic See. Showing here then that Francis Shepcart, for this reason alone, would have been excommunicated ipso facto, reserved in the special manager of the Apostolic See, and of course then he's never been absolved from that. If he's excommunicated, he has no real spiritual jurisdiction. And to prove he has no real spiritual jurisdiction if excommunicated, I turn to again the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, page 2645, question 22, article 3, where St. Thomas answers, "Jurisdiction can only be used in relation to another man. Consequently, since every excommunicated person is separate from the communion of the faithful, he is deprived of the use of jurisdiction." And then the same question 22, article 3, reply to objection 1, St. Thomas goes on to write, "Although an excommunicated or suspended person does not lose his jurisdiction, yet he does lose its use." And from that it must follow to everyone with reasoning that if Francis Shepcart is excommunicated and lost his office, suspended, has no jurisdiction in the church, he certainly cannot receive the vow of obedience or any of the vows, and therefore there's no religious profession of anyone in the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe. And because many traditionalists today, and I'll just now say the superiors of the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen of the Universe, would like to dismiss all these teachings of the Church I tried to explain so far, simply by saying that Epikaya can be invoked and none of these things apply today. Let me then try to explain my views and share with you the research I found on this particular area. And first, I will just read from the commentary on the new Code of Canon Law by the Reverend Charles Augustine, OSB. I'm now reading from Volume 3, page 231 under Canon 555. I take note that that is Canon 555 because this is an invalidating law. And I read this from Father Augustine's Canon Law book because he gives the translation in English. So Canon 555 reads here, "Besides the other conditions enumerated in Canon 542 for the validity of the novitiate, it is further required that the novitiate be made, 1, after the aspirant has completed at least the 15th year, 2, for an entire and uninterrupted year, and 3, in the novitiate house." And I say then that this year novitiate has not been made by many people, and yet this Canon 555 requires it. And to know without any doubt that Canon 555 is an invalidating law, I turn to another book by Edward Rockler, STD, Professor of Canon Law at the Catholic University of America, 1955, St. Anthony Guild Press, Patterson, New Jersey. I have an equal update by Hieronymus D. Hannon and an imprimatur by Carolus J. Alter, D.D., 15th of March, 1954. And in this book on the validating laws, Father Edward Ruckler explains very many things of great importance, especially in the world today. And he dedicates a whole chapter here to the identification of invalidating laws. And I read on page 144 then that because of the words Ut Valiat, canons 187 and here canon 555 is certainly an invalidating law. And I return once more to this very important book, The Nature, History, and Use of Epikaya by Father Joseph Riley, which the book itself contains, I believe, at least 494 pages, and has a bibliography of at least 24 sources altogether, plus about 600 early reference works. And I mention that because I want you to know that Father Riley did a very extensive job in teaching us these truths of the Church about Epikaya. And Father Riley goes through in chapter 8 of this book, in Epikaya, Human Invalidating Laws, beginning on page 373. And it goes down to the opinions, the affirmative and the negative, and many other things here, down to page 446, all on human invalidating laws. And I obviously am not going to read that right now, but I am simply going to state that he gives reference to 20 or 21 different theologians that tell us that Epikaya cannot be applied to human invalidating laws. Among these theologians are Cyrus, San Alfonso Maria Liguori, McHugh Callan, and I just make note that those are the ones who give the most approved translation of English version of the Catechism of the Council of Trent. And the authors he cites as telling us this are Joan, Schilling, Oliano, Antonius Nicholas, Weldon Smith, Plummer, and a number of others. And so from his works and reading what he says here, I agree with his teaching of the Church that human invalidating laws sometimes cease to bind, but Epikaya may not be applied to human invalidating laws. And as I just stated a while ago, Canon 555 is a human invalidating law. It requires a full year of novitiate, properly made, and that's why I said that Epikaya cannot be applied to this. And from the same book, I repeat once more that Epikaya may not be applied to the precepts of the natural law. And so from all these things I've tried to explain here in this tape, I reinstate that I do not believe now that anyone ever made a valid religious profession in the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Universe that was started up by Brother Francis Conrad Schuckardt. And if there is anyone still in the world who does believe that they've made a valid religious profession, I wish they will hear this tape and, if necessary, research all these things out for themselves and then explain to me how they came up with their conclusion that somehow they run against all these teachings of the true Church and declare that anyone made a religious valid profession in the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Universe. And if anyone does believe that there is such a thing as this valid religious profession, I'm only stating now that there are many, many other things that I could discuss that point out my views. And someday I hope to discuss these things and put them on tape and let people know if they're interested in them. Please pray for me, and may the Holy Family of Jesus, Mary, and Saint Joseph grant to each and every one of us the grace we need to know the truth, live the truth, love the truth, live and die in the true Catholic faith in the state of sanctifying grace, having obtained that degree of holiness, and as God's holy will we obtain. In listening to this tape again before sending it out, I picked up a couple of errors that I wish to correct at this time. One of them was on side one of this tape, I believe, when I was dubbing in from the talks that Father Dennis Phillips and me gave on June 4th and then on June 17th. And I think I said something to the effect that after